I'll switch to English to make it more accessible to our non-Czech speakers or Czech non-speakers or whatever. What I'm going to talk about is would not be possible without the help of literally hundreds of other people. I just tried to highlight some of the more important ones here, and especially I should thank to Martin Popel and Milan Straka, who did a terrific job in helping me with this. So the topic is Kernel shared task in multilingual parsing from raw text to universal dependencies. So I'm assuming in this audience I don't really need to introduce what is universal dependencies and what is dependency parsing, right? If that's not true, please raise your hands. Okay. So there's this long tradition of having shared tasks in natural language processing, and that includes parsing and dependency parsing. I believe probably the oldest one, at least the oldest one that I'm aware of, shared task in parsing was in like 11 years ago, Kernel shared task 2006, which was also a huge impulse for subsequent interest in multilingual parsing, so not focusing just on English. There were 13 languages, and a number of teams tried to provide the outputs on the test data for that. Then there was a subsequent shared task in 2007, again associated with the Kernel conference, with slightly different set of languages. And and then there were many others. So 2008 and 9, although there was a focus on semantic dependencies, again, the surface syntax was part of the task, so you could view it as another continuation of the tradition, and there were new advances in dependency parsing. Two smaller tasks in India focused on Indian languages. SPMRL is an abbreviation of syntactic parsing of morphologically rich languages. Again, 2 years with this set of languages. I'm sorry, I'm just using the ISO language codes for brevity, so if you want an explanation, please let me know. And more recently this year, there was this Vardayo shared task, which was focused on cross-lingual parsing. So essentially, you have a pair of related languages like Czech and Slovak. And the assumption here is you don't have any training data for the target language, but you have plenty of data in the source language. And because they are related, you try to train something on Czech and apply to Slovak, for instance. And there were Slovenian and Croatian and Danish, Swedish on the source side, Norwegian on the target side. So this is something we took part in. It was a small task, but as far as I know, it was the first task which really did something with the universal dependencies data. And finally, this year we are organizing a large task. You could say like Kernel after 11 years, but this time it's really probably the largest parsing task so far in terms of number of languages, and there's also a couple of extra novel aspects which I will be talking about in a minute. So our intention here was to include all languages for which we have data, so not to exclude anything, because it's also an important visibility aspect for the providers of the data. There were just two exceptions. One of them was if the tree bank is so small that we couldn't really test anything, and the threshold was set to 10,000 words available for testing, then we excluded it. And also for data that are not publicly available, and we have some such tree banks in UD, then we excluded it because we wanted the data sets to be available for any follow-up research without obstacles. So we had to exclude one Arabic tree bank because it's a large one, but in UD there's only the annotation but not the underlying text. So if you want to have the data, you would have to obtain it separately and then merge it together with the UD annotation. So it's not suitable for the task. And because of the 10,000 test words condition, we had to exclude Belarusian, Coptic, Lithuanian, Sanskrit, and Tamil. And that's it. We did include some other languages for which we have the 10,000 test words available. But because of that, we have really small training data, especially the boldface one, Kazakh and Uyghur, for which we have almost no training data at all. But we have the test data. So the participants would have to use some cross-lingual techniques to train a parser on something else than the Kazakh data, because there is non-Kazakh data, and try to apply it to the test data that we provide. In addition to that, we have also four surprise languages, Buryat, Kurdish, Northern Sami, and Upper Sorbian. So these were the surprise language means that not only there is no training data, but also the participants didn't know what the languages were going to be until like a week before the test phase. So I think 2 weeks ago. Then we told them what the languages are going to be, and we provided a small sample so that they could at least see something, how the data looks like, whether Kurdish is written in Latin or Arabic alphabet and so on. But they still had to apply some cross-language training, model transfer. So the only difference between the surprise languages and, for instance, Kazakh is that for Kazakh, you knew well in advance that Kazakh will be one of the languages. So you could prepare something. Maybe you would decide, okay, let's improve my ability to train something on Turkish because Turkish is related and we have training data, for instance. Otherwise, Kazakh was very similar to the surprise languages. And even more, beyond this test set, there is also a brand new parallel tree bank annotated in UD style, provided by various sites, most notably DFKI in Germany did translation, and Google did the annotation of most of the languages. So in the task, we have 14 languages. These are not surprise languages. These are languages that are available. We have training data for them, but this is a new data set, and it's not necessarily the same domain, so it may be difficult for the participants to decide what model to use. If you have participated in a shared task or seen rules of some shared task, you may have noticed that quite often there are two tracks, open track and closed track, which means that in the closed track, you are supposed to only train your system on the data provided by the organizers, so that everyone is sort of on the same page and it's more comparable, while in the open track, people are generally allowed to use any data whatsoever, and then they can compare whether the additional data helped them or not. We decided that the task was already complex enough, so we didn't want to further split it into two tracks. Instead, we had just one large track where we included pretty much everything. Formally, the track was closed, but we really wanted people to be able to use anything that they believe would help them, as long as these were data that are publicly available, so that even after the shared task, people can develop new systems and compare them and have the same conditions available. So we listed a number of available resources. We even asked the participants to propose some other data sets that they wanted to use. So this is already extended. So someone proposed they wanted to use Wikipedia dumps. So we said, okay, it's freely available, let's use it. Obviously, not everyone used everything here, but they had the opportunity. Common crawl is a special thing here, thanks to especially the folks at the University of Turku and Milan Straka here. We have a huge corpus of raw text from the web for almost all the languages, obviously different sizes for different languages. I think in total it's something like 90 billion words. which is now available. Wurttemberg's counted on that, and it's even pre-processed and parsed for whoever wants to use it. If you have worked with universal dependencies, you also may know that for some languages, we have more than one tree bank there. So for instance, for English, we have something labeled UD English, which is the web tree bank annotated at Stanford. We also have UD English Linus, which is the English part of Swedish English parallel tree bank. Now we also have parallel TUT, Turin University tree bank, which again has English and two other languages there. And we also have this PUD is the new parallel test set that we created just for the shared task. So there are four different English data sets in the task, and each of them was evaluated separately, as if they were separate languages. But for the first three, there are also corresponding training data. And the participants were able to learn from the language codes which test set their system is now going to process. So they could select, they could say, okay, I have one model trained on UD English, the training part of it, one other model trained on UD English Linus, and now I'm going to process UD English Linus test set, so I will just use this model. Another team could have decided, okay, I have these two training data sets, and I believe because together that will be a larger training set, I will use a model that's trained on both to parse any of these. That's also a valid decision. Even if they decided that they have a model trained on all the other languages, English and French and Italian, I don't know what, they could still use it. So that was their decision. But there was always the danger that the target test set will be a different domain. So some of them are fiction, some others are blog, social reviews, and so on. So that's also something to consider. In total, we have 81 test files, which includes there are 45 normal languages, 4 surprise languages, and the rest is additional data sets for existing languages. And the main score, we have a lot of different statistics that we are able to compute and publish, but the main system score that we use to rank all the systems submitted is the macro average labeled attachment score across all these 81 files. Now, the other important aspect that is novel in this shared task in comparison to the previous ones is that we want the results to really tell us something about the real-world scenario. So previously, the usual scenario was that the parser got an input gold standard part of speech text, human assigned part of speech, gold standard tokenization, and it only focused on parsing. But you never knew whether if you take that parser and apply it to new text, whether your accuracy will still be 80% as you read in the paper, or it will be something much less because you are not able to reproduce the tokenization scheme that they used, and the parser obviously behaves much differently. So in this task, we wanted the participants to really process the raw text, and we didn't provide them with any gold standard processing whatsoever. So that includes sentence segmentation, tokenization, word segmentation, and morphology if it's necessary for the parser. Some parsers just ignore morphology and they train directly the syntactic structure. The only exception here is the morphology for the surprise languages was available, and it was predicted based on a model trained on the test data, like cross-validation style. So we took one part of the test data, trained the model, and applied to the other part of the test data so that you don't apply it on the part that it was trained on. But that is the only thing that the participants would not be able to train themselves. And then parsing is the last step that the systems were supposed to do. To make the task more accessible, because you see this is a lot of work and a lot of different models that people would have to train, we provided a baseline system. This is the well-known UD pipe done by Milan Straka from this building. And that actually includes a parser. But so we trained, Milan trained baseline models, and everyone could download the parser, including the models, and start with that. So you could start with an existing parser that produces the baseline accuracy of the parsing, and then try to improve it somehow. But even if you wanted to use your own parser, we provided the test data pre-processed by UDPipe. So if you didn't want to care about tokenization and sentence segmentation and so on, because you really wanted to do only parsing, then you could take the output of UDPipe pre-processing just without any syntax, and then you would add just syntax. Obviously, that means that you trust UDPipe and you believe that its segmentation and morphology is the best you can get. If there are any errors, then your parser will probably suffer from them. So that's UDPipe. We also announced there is another baseline system, SyntaxNet, from Google. It is a baseline system in the sense that it has also, it is open source, and it comes with models pre-trained for a shared task, so you could directly download it and use it. But I am not able to provide any evaluation of the system because they didn't actually run it in the framework of the shared task. Finally, as we are talking about accessibility of the task, if you didn't want to do anything for the surprise languages or more general for the low resource languages, again, you could probably just take one of the baseline models for any other language or a simple delexicalized parser, and that's it. You will get low score probably for the low resource languages, but because we average everything over the 81 test files, there is still a good chance that you will get a higher score altogether if your parser is really good on the normal languages. Now, because of the setup of the task this way, we also need to apply a specific method for evaluation. Normally, dependency parsing is evaluated very easily by something called label attachment score. You just look at every word, and if and then you look at the link to its parent node, and if it's the same in the gold standard annotation and in the system output, then the system gets 1 point. And then you compute a number of correct hits, and that's the accuracy. In this case, it's not clear how many nodes there actually are supposed to be, because the system may have a different tokenization than in the gold standard. So the first thing that we have to do is to align the gold annotation to the system output. For most part, it is pretty easy, because the systems are really not supposed to differ in anything else than white space. So in this example here, this is actually the first sentence from the English English data. There's Al-Zaman, that's the name of a newspaper or something, colon, American forces killed, blah, blah, blah. And the system here happened to take Al-Zaman as one token, because this is how it was written in the underlying text, while in the gold standard annotation is three tokens. So even though we have here token number 1, 2, 3, and here is number 5, we will still be able to pretty easily match American to American, because we know that if you just ignore the spaces, that this goes from position 0 to position 7, this goes also from position 0 to position 7, and you just mark that these don't match. So there's a problem here that will be reflected in the evaluation. Essentially, if we cannot align a node to the gold standard annotation, any dependency going into the node or out of the node is considered incorrect. So that's the simple rule of thumb here. But we still will be able to say that American and American match each other, so that if this is attached correctly, there will be a good point into the score. Now, if you know UD, then you also know that there is a special secondary level of word segmentation. There is something we call multi-word tokens. So a surface token can be split into multiple syntactic words. So in this German example, im is a contraction of a preposition and article, preposition in and article dem. And in the surface text, you will not see the in dem, while in the gold standard annotation in the tree, there will be these two nodes. So that's another level that the systems have to predict. And now the evaluation becomes more difficult because this no longer corresponds to whatever you see in the surface text. But fortunately, in the file format that we use, both the gold standard annotation and the system output must contain a marking that will tell you now we are entering a multi-word token. So the system will say, now I believe there is a multi-word token and I'm here it starts and I will tell you when it ends. So we can align the normal words as previously, and only when we see on either side that there is a multi-word token, we have to do something special. And that something special is the algorithm for finding longest common subsequence within the syntactic words in the multi-word token. So in this made-up example, if the system just goes crazy and generates a lot of nonsense here, but still marks this as one multi-word token, then the algorithm will see that there is in here and there is in there, there is dim, dim here, so there's a match. And even though probably the system will have the dependency links wrong here, so it will not get any score anyway, if it happens to have these, the dependencies for in and dim as expected in the gold standard data, then it will get a point for that. But it will not get any point for einem, alle zustimmen, because these nodes don't align to anything. Now, I'll not go into much detail, many details here. Essentially, you know, cannot identify nodes by just their index in the sentence, because as we've seen, the indices in the gold standard data and the system output may not be the same. So we have really matched the node objects to be sure that these two align to each other. And as I said, if you cannot align a system output node to the gold standard, then any dependency going in or out is wrong. What about sentence boundaries? We don't do or we don't evaluate sentence segmentation directly. So that means we just take the whole text, the whole document, the whole file. But again, if your system has one error in sentence segmentation, then necessarily it is at least one incorrect dependency there. So indirectly, you will still get a penalization for that. And now finally, the score, because we don't know the correct number of nodes, or because the correct number of nodes may not be the same as the system output, we cannot use the normal just accuracy. We have to do precision and recall instead. So precision essentially counts, it's a ratio of how much of what the system predicted was really correct, and recall is how much of what it was supposed to predict was correctly predicted. And this is a standard way of combining the two numbers so that we get just one, and that's what we call label attachment score in this task. So far about the evaluation scheme, I have a couple more when I will show you the results. Now, the final bit of novelty in this task was that the evaluation was done completely blind way at a remote server. That's a new platform called Tyra or Tira, I don't know how they prefer to pronounce it. And the participating teams don't just take the test data, process it at their site, and then submit the process data. Instead, they have to submit their systems. So that means they install their software at a remote machine. Then it's run over there, and everything stays there. So what that means in practice, there's a virtual machine in Tyra for each team. There is some basic default setting with number of processors and amount of memory available and so on. For most of the teams, this turned out to be insufficient for a parser, but they could ask for more, so most of them did. And as far as I was able to observe, the only request that was not that they were not able to honor this year was any GPUs. They said it's on our to-do list, but it wasn't available here. Otherwise, if the system, if the teams wanted like to have 8 CPUs just for them and 128 giga RAM, they just got it. They could get operating system of their choosing from a limited choice list, but most of them chose Ubuntu, and they got complete administrative access to that machine, so they could install everything that they needed for their system, so that could really be something complex with a lot of libraries, but it's all inside the virtual machine, which the main motivation here is that it improves the reproducibility of the experiments. So after the shared task, there will still be archive of these virtual machines, and at least in theory, it should be possible 1 year from now or 2 years from now to rerun it on new data sets, exactly the same system, and compare the results and so on. So that's one thing. By the way, this was not our idea to run the task this way, but this is now a strong recommendation of the Signal committee that runs the kernel conferences. So we just said, okay, sounds like a good idea, we will do it. It's a new thing. I think the previous kernel shared task was done this way, but before that they didn't use Tyra. Now, when you have your system in the virtual machine, you're supposed to sort of remote control it through the web interface they provide. And while it is running on the test data, it is so-called sandboxed, which means it is detached from the internet, and you can't see anything except that it's running, or at least they say it's running. And only after it stops, you will be able to get some feedback, and usually if it's on the real test data, you will still not see anything, because the motivation here is that we should prevent any leakage of the test data. So unless the moderators of the task authorize some information to be passed to the participants, they will not see anything. Obviously, this is sort of good for making the environment fair competition for everyone, especially preventing the people from tuning their systems on the real test data. At the same time, it makes the task extremely difficult. And it turned out that for some of the teams, this was really a killing feature. And some others struggled through the week of the test phase very, very hardly. So hardly that actually Jamel Sedak created a hashtag on Twitter called Parsing Tragedy, and I believe many people followed it. So just to give you a couple of examples. You could debug actually on the development data, so there you could see something more, because development data was not secret. But there is still a lot of obstacles that could come into your way. One of them is the surprise languages. Another, so there are test files that you never encounter into development data. Some of the parsers just were not prepared correctly for the new files. They failed to find a model or something, and they crashed. And now if it crashes, you just know that it after the run is over, you can run the evaluator, but you don't see any scores if it's not development data, if it's test data. Because we didn't want them to just try, okay, my model now gives me 65%, I will try another one, wow, it gives me 67%, so I will submit this one. We didn't want that to be done on the test data. So because of that, they were not allowed to see the real scores. So the only thing that the evaluator told them was, you're fine, you got non-zero score on these files. And if it was 81 OKs, then they may have thought, okay, maybe it's fine. But sometimes non-zero score meant something like 0.55%, which was still a bug, but they wouldn't see it. So there was another level. I, as the moderator, I was able to tell them, look, I normally would not tell you your score, but because it's just 0.55%, I am telling you that there is something wrong with it. And then I could look at their system the standard error output of their system, and if I believe that it doesn't leak any vital information about the contents of the test data, if it's just diagnostic of that system, then I could even unblind the run so that they could see diagnostic and see maybe there was a bug message that they could understand. But obviously that takes a lot of time, and I wasn't available around the clock, and sometimes because there were so many systems, sometimes it took like 1 day or something before I replied. So that was also quite frustrating for some of the teams. And then imagine this possibility. Your system runs for 2 days. It was not supposed to run that long because on development data it just took 5 hours, but still you don't want to kill it because you want your results and hopefully it's producing something. And even I, as the moderator, I was not able to enter the virtual machine while it was running. It was actually possible, but only by the administrators of Tyra. So that was actually my feedback to Tyra that next time they should find out a way how to make this available at least for the task moderator, because some of the teams really suffered from not being able to realize that their system is not doing nothing. That their system just slept in an endless loop for 2 days until they became nervous, and on the third day they asked us to kill it, and then we found out there was just the first two files output and nothing else, so they had to rerun it, but there was no time left because it was the deadline was coming. So at the end we had to allow them to just run it partially, not on all the 801 files in one run, but just on part of it, and then we had to stitch the runs together so that we got the final score. Then there were other systems, which were actually those that followed the parsing tragedy hashtag, who looked like the system finished successfully. Everything looked okay. There was an okay score for all the 81 files. When I looked at the score, I said, okay, they are not really good, but 60% doesn't look bad, so there's probably no bug. Then only after we unblinded everything and showed them their diagnostic output and published the test data, they realized that the parser did not recognize any single language because of some stupid bug. So they just, for all the 81 files, they didn't know what language it was. But the parser was robust enough to switch to a generic mode instead of just crashing what the other systems did. So they were still able to produce 60% accurate output without even knowing what language they were parsing. But the tragedy is that when they finally reran it, they found out they would have 70% and would get like the sixth rank instead of 26th. So that's the other possibility, unfortunately. So that's some really a lesson we learned. So now I'm getting to the results. We had originally 111 registrations. Obviously, some of them just tried it and then forgot it. So and somewhere in the middle of the timeline, we had 56 teams which really got a virtual machine. So they like took the next step. Only 38 of them logged in the Tyra interface. So you see like the dropping, not dropping interest, but maybe they gradually more and more teams found it too difficult for them. I actually got two official withdrawals from the task, but many others just disappeared. 34 ran something, and most of them also reached non-zero score on test data. That actually includes a couple of teams that did not reach non-zero on all of the files, so some of them got a really bad score, but most of them got something reasonably comparable. If we compare it to the old shared task in 2006 and 7, we still have a larger number of surviving teams, so I think the task is success in this way, even though it was way more difficult than those tasks. And these are the main results and the main metric we have. It was quite interesting for me to observe it from distance because I knew what the scores were. The participants did not. So for most of the week, these two were running something which took really a lot of time. Like I think IMS needed like 25 hours to parse the 81 files on that infrastructure. But it was obvious from the very first result they got that they were good. This is Cornell University from New York State. They were also, I just didn't know which one of them would be the first. As you can see, neither, because right before the deadline, the Stanford parser, this is not the well-known Stanford parser, this is a new one that a student from Chris Manning did over the last year, so, but hopefully that will become the new Stanford parser. They just came in, ran for 16 hours, and they beat everyone. So that's these numbers are really impressive because that includes all the surprise languages and all the low-resource languages. So for the real languages where you have a lot of training data, the scores are much higher because this is the average. As you can see, UDPipe, the improved one, this is the baseline that we provided for everyone. And then Milan took part in the contest with the improved version of that, and obviously it was an improvement. So this is impressive, I guess. Now, these are the unofficial results. When you include all the runs that people did unofficially after the deadline, or even some of the teams did multiple runs during the test phase, but then they indicated that their final submission is something else that was actually their best scoring submission. So this is the most unfortunate team, probably. Uppsala is very similar, but a different cause for the failure. They used publicly available library called Dynet, and only during or after the task, they found out that if you use that library for training on your own computer, and then you run it on the other computer in the virtual machine, then it does not produce the same results. So they also were, in the official results, they were way down here, somewhere 20-something, but with the unofficial result, they would jump quite high. There's a lot of statistics that I could show you. I won't because we don't have time. So you could go to the website and there is a lot of other tables. One of the more interesting ones, I guess, is work segmentation. Again, there were multiple levels of what we call segmentation, but this is one of the important ones, which sort of shows that many teams use probably the baseline segmentation because they have the same score as the baseline here. Some of them were able to improve it. Among them, those who scored in the overall score quite high, but not all of them. So Cornell is here, Stanford, I don't know. So maybe Stanford even failed in this, but still their parser is very good. Although we don't have all the analysis now, it doesn't seem to have a very significant impact on the parsing results. I will very briefly touch on a topic that we have like a side effect of this right now. Joachim Nivre has proposed a special UD-focused evaluation metric, which essentially is focused on content words because UD is centered around content word dependencies. And the motivation behind this is that what is expressed by analytical forms or various auxiliaries in one language might be expressed by just morphology in another language. So the same sentence in English and in Finnish might have 8 words on one side and 4 words on the other side. So one wrong word in Finnish will cost the parser much more error points than in English. So the idea here was to just disregard all the dependency relations that are for auxiliaries, and we got these statistics as a like a secondary metric, not the main one for scoring systems. I think the interesting thing here is that most of the time the ranking of the parsers is the same. So probably the systems don't really optimize towards doing the auxiliary words, which are maybe easier to get to do just them. For the surprise languages, it turns out that these were really difficult. So 47% accuracy of parsing probably means that the output is still quite useless. But again, this is the average. And if you remember what these languages were, Upper Sorbian is actually an outlier here. Upper Sorbian was sort of easy for the parsers when compared to the others, to get. Some parsers even got over 60% on upper Sorbian. So that is something that you already could work with. Quite likely because we have a lot of Slavic languages in the pool. Otherwise, Buryat, Kurdish, and Northern Sami proved to be very far from anything we had. But still, the systems that just ignore it got something like below 20% accuracy on those languages. And obviously, these two were focused on getting the surprise languages as good as possible. So they had an ensemble of parsers and various cross-lingual techniques. They even consulted the word atlas of languages for various features that could be present in the languages. And my final two slides are about sort of ranking of tree banks in terms of how far you can get with parsing accuracy on the data that we have. So this was sort of surprising for me, actually, that for Czech, we are able to even get something over 90%. Those of you who remember the accuracies that we had for Prague Dependency Tree Bank were the best possible for many years, was something like 86%. This looks impressive. Of course, these numbers cannot be directly compared because Prague Dependency Tree Bank is a different annotation style. There is no way of telling whether how these two would compare. Maybe analyzing UD is easier than analyzing PDT. But still, the 86% that we used to cite for PDT were unlabeled attachment score, so you did not include whether the label of the dependency was correct or not. And it was usually produced by parsers which ran on, which were trained on gold standard part of speech text and gold standard tokenization. So remember that this is end-to-end parsing from the raw text. Everything is just predicted, nothing is gold standard on the input. And this is labeled accuracy. So it still looks like good. And there are other Slavic languages here. And now for this sort of table, it would actually make sense to look at the Joachim's special metric. So I have the same ranking with class as well. And there are now more differences than with just the parsers. But not so large differences that I would expect. Essentially, some of the languages which have a lot of auxiliary words, like Romance languages, Portuguese, Catalan, Italian, dropped a bit, but they are still in the first 15, so it was not such a huge drop. English is way down somewhere. So I don't have really a conclusion here because we are still, right now, we are writing the overview paper, so we still don't have all the knowledge of what the different parsers used. Essentially, the one message here is that the neural tsunami hit here as well. I believe all of the parsers use some sort of neural network inside. Otherwise, whatever you would like to learn about the task is at its website.
Are tired. I have a question. If some of those output have a significance and confidence interval for this metric, labeled attachment score with F score, please tell me. I'm programming it right now, but any ideas are
do you think that if the submission process was simpler and it didn't use all those virtual machines and the blind submissions, etc., that there would be more participants who would successfully complete the system?
It is difficult to say. I definitely know about a number of teams that failed to get to the end because they had big problems with the virtual machines, but they were already in the process. So there may have been others who just decided not even to log in Tyra because they decided it was too difficult for them. I don't know about them. On the other hand, for me as the organizer, Tyra provides a very comfortable way of observing what's going on. So I know that someone has a problem. The problem was that I wasn't able to react timely in many cases during the test phase week when everyone was in panic mode. But otherwise, in a normal or normal classical setup of task where everyone is working at home and then or at their institute and then they just submit the processed files, you may not know until the very end that they are struggling with something where maybe you could be of help or not. So then you only at the when the deadline strikes, you realize that you have only 15 participants and maybe you could have 20, but you don't know why. So there are like two sides of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, right.
So actually, you. This is working. Anyway, you can hear me. So actually, you. Okay. So using the virtual machine was not hard. I mean, it was very easy to log in, and Martin Podhast, who sets them up, was very helpful. You could ask him for more RAM, more things to help out. The extremely hard thing was that you saw no output from your system. So I don't know, the only thing that could have changed that would have made it easier for the participants is that some kind of sanitized output could be shown to them. That's basically the only thing I think that could make it easier. Otherwise, for some people, I think it was actually better because it could be that you have way more power on the virtual machine than you have on your home computer. So you could do the training on there as well.
I think if I can follow up on that, for some people who would otherwise run it at their own laptop, it was definitely more powerful to run it in the virtual machine. Some others, actually, the Stuttgart guys complained that they have a powerful cluster at their site, which probably would allow them to run something much more ambitious than they did in the virtual machine. But I think at the end they were quite happy because they got a lot more resources.
I have one question. I'm sorry, I probably missed something, but I would like to know the interpretation of one of the last tables when you had the tree banks. Yeah, this one or the one before. What does it mean? I mean, when you compare, what does it mean, tree bank ranking?
It doesn't mean much. It doesn't. I mean, I would be very careful to interpret this as any sort of language parsing difficulty or whatever. But I think it, at least for people who were used to work with one or a couple of particle languages, it may be interesting to see also the per language best scores because you know what's now possible, at least in the UD annotation style. So for me, knowing that Stanford has the 76 aggregated score tells me that the Stanford pass is very good, but I still don't know whether it's good for Czech as well, although probably it is. Well, this tells me that it is the best one and how good it is. One interesting exception in this Stanford everything column is this TRL is actually a Tokyo IBM research team who were really bad in everything because they did something unsupervised or so they told me that they didn't mind bad scores except for Japanese. And when I helped them debugging something, it was actually obvious from seeing the output of the system, the diagnostic output, where it was like all the time starting language, Buria doing something, okay, outputting something, starting language, Bulgarian, all the same. And when it tasted Japanese on input, I say, it suddenly did something else. And it was a lot of output and launching this module, that module, blah, 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 blah. And finally, they got 91%. They were not so successful in the other Japanese data set we had. We had this also in the parallel tree bank, which was new in this task. Because they had some bug somewhere in the, in their processing pipeline. I believe they have a lot of rule-based and really Japanese specific modules there. And one of them somehow messed up the tokenization. And the evaluation procedure is really strict about getting the same sequence of symbols, non-white space symbols, on both sides. And whenever there is missing a single quotation mark, which was their case, then the, it's just invalid. Because you lost a symbol that was on the input and you were not supposed to delete it. So for that reason, they first got zero on the data set, and because they were really frustrated to get zero on another Japanese test set, then they switched. When I told them that there was this bug somewhere, but I didn't tell them where, because I didn't want to reveal the actual contents of the data. So they switched to the generic mode and did their unsupervised thing as for every other language and got just 40% or something.
Thank you.
I just wanted one more question about this ranking. Is there a correlation between the results and the test, the trained data size? I mean, perhaps the parsers should get better results when the training data are larger, and then less. It's not perhaps
that's
that
a
much
good
about
point.
Language difficulty, but about the size of the training data.
I think it would be both. That's a good point. Definitely, both the check sets that we see here are pretty large in comparison to the others. Syntagros is also very large. I think after the Prague Dependency Tree Bank, it is the second largest training set we have in UD. But we don't really know, because the teams were allowed to train on anything. So we don't know whether those who parsed successfully these two check sets, whether they trained on combination of the two tree banks or on just one of them. I believe we will be able to read that from their system description papers. But so far, I already have the papers. They are under review now, but I wasn't able to read them all.
Along similar lines, did you notice any significant change in performance between across tree banks with a lot of non-projective sentences, as opposed to ones that were more projective? So I believe ancient Greek was famously non-projective. Did it show up a lot worse than the others?
I don't know.
Okay.
You would have to look at the tables.
I
don't even have
up.
The statistics of non-projectivities, although I know that ancient Greek has a lot of them in the data set.
Yep.
So good question, no answer,
okay.
Sorry.
Děkuji ještě jednou všem třem řečníkům. Já myslím, že jsme měli letos krásný závěr tohoto akademického roku v rámci našeho semináře. Těším se, že se sejdem příští rok. Můžu vám ohlásit nebo předem ohlásit dvě takové třešničky, které doufám se nám podaří utrhnout. Máme to slíbeno. Jedna bude trochu v rámci ne toho, co říkal Dan, ale spíš typologie, tedy lingvistického rámce, typologie a universal dependencies a jak se to má dohromady. William Croft slíbil, že přijede na podzim, a druhý host bude Barbara Grossová, přední komputační lingvistka původem, abych tak řekla. Dneska už spíš se zabývá víc umělou inteligencí jako computer science. Nicméně je to jedna z nejpřednějších komputačních lingvistů této éry, nebo jak se ukáže na ACL letos. Takže myslím, že a to bude na jaře. Takže myslím, že budeme se mít na co těšit. Tak ještě jednou děkuju moc krát, přeju hezký prázdniny a těším se na shledanou.